My name is Deanne Lagerquist. Lots of familiar faces, but we say this every time in case 20 years from now somebody picks up this tape and wants to know who's talking. I teach at St. Olaf College in the religion department. I am a historian of Christianity with a particular interest in women's history. But maybe I should say something at this point about my understanding of history, because the things that we've done the last 2 days feed into, in my view, not only our understanding of ourselves and our own situation, but the way we begin to think about the future. So I often tell my students that history is the use of the past in the present toward the future. And when I hear people say, it's sort of a colloquialism, oh, that's history, so-and-so is history, and it's just the past tense, I always leap up. No, that's not what history is, not simply the past tense. History is how we use the past to help us understand what's going on now and to help us know where we want to go in the future. That means we have to keep redoing history. We have to keep asking new questions, looking for new sources, and analyzing them in new ways, because our lives and the lives of our communities change. So that's what we've been doing the last 2 days. The first day talking about what is woman, different ways of defining woman, talking about the way woman is a marked category, that woman is often thought of as the unusual case, but in a few instances, woman is used as the ideal case, woman as the ideal Christian, as in the case of certain Puritan divines. And then yesterday, looking at very quickly a few women through the history of the church and the sorts of activities that they have been involved in. Both of those sessions feed into a discussion of contemporary ministry. The whole series expands on a set of presentations I did for the Lutheran Deaconess Association earlier in the summer about women's ministry. And I admitted to them that I didn't really come to any sort of conclusion that was administratively useful or operationalizable. It's an ugly word, but you hear it a lot. You know, you have to have a mission statement that you can operationalize. You have to be able to put it into operation. I see some of you smiling that you have encountered that. The ELCA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, is currently involved in a 6-year-long task force on the study of ministry. And although they talk theology, I think in large degree what they're concerned about is an operational administrative definition. When I addressed them, I talked to them about what women have done and the changes and the issues that that raises for us. Some of the issues that women's activity raise for us about ministry have to do with administrative categories. Rostering. What do you do with deaconesses? What do you do with school teachers? What do you do about parental leave for women who want to take more than 6 weeks with newborn children? Those are administrative issues. And some of them have to do with clergy, but not all of them. Okay. Some of the questions that arise about women's ministry that aren't of that sort are these. Are women more suited to imitate Christ's sacrifice and suffering than are men? That's something you read. It's usually not that blunt. Most people don't come right out and say, women are more suited to suffering and sacrifice than men, and therefore more Christ-like. But the implication is often there. Is that the case? I think it's particularly a difficult question in the context of Christianity because of the centrality of kenosis to our understanding of who Jesus is. The self-emptying that we read about in the Philippian hymn, Christ, who did not count his equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself and became a servant. Since servanthood and emptying of self are central to our understanding of the gospel, it complicates any effort to just say, I am who I am, I'm important, pay attention to me. That needs to be said. But how it's said, is a very important and difficult matter, I think, particularly for women in the late 20th century. As we're struggling, many of us, to move beyond self-denigration, one of the earliest pieces of feminist theology that was written in about 1960 by a woman named Valerie Saving was about the notions of sin. And very briefly, Saving said that Christian theologians have tended to define sin entirely with regard to will to power, desire to be like God, and that frequently in women's experience, that's not the problem. The problem isn't trying to be like God. The problem is what I would describe as denying the image of God that is in us. To say, I'm not important, I don't matter, just walk all over me, let me take care of you. That's denying that I matter because I'm in the image of God. Okay. So as I talk to these deaconesses, I try to move to say, what other things are there about Christ that we should imitate? Not just suffering and sacrifice. What about incarnation? What about resurrection? What are the ways that our ministries to one another are not only about suffering and sacrifice and resistance of evil? How are they also about incarnation, a sort of embracing of life, embracing of the ordinary? How are they about resurrection and transcending the forces of evil and death? Another way to consider women's ministry is to look at what women have done, and from that data to describe some ministries. And that's an approach I took in a little essay I referred to yesterday, which is in Serving the Word. It's called There Are Many Workers in God's Household. And there I wrote about administration, patronage, hospitality, and teaching. Ministries that are very important in the community of Christ, but which may get lost as our changing lives move us to do different things. The ministry of hospitality, we talk about that a lot at Holden. It has to do, I think, with making people comfortable, making them welcome, letting them know that they matter. And you know what group has done that the most in congregations? The women's organizations. And as those women's organizations no longer are able to do those tasks, we need to ask, how will that ministry be carried out? Not just say, oh, those young women, they won't serve any funeral luncheons. They won't come home from their office and make sandwiches. That's not going to solve the problem. That's not the answer. But the question remains, how will the ministry of hospitality be carried out? Are there new ways to do that? I think a third approach to considering women's ministry in our era, and a distinctly, although not uniquely, uniquely Lutheran way to do that, is to talk about vocation and calling. It takes us back to what is ministry. And I think it helps us avoid falling into the trap of only talking about professional ministers, people who have training, people who get money for what they do. And instead comes back to us. What talents has God given us, and how are we able to use those in a way that reveals the image of God in us and meets the needs of our neighbors? I think both of those things need to be taken into account. How does it allow me to show the Christ that is in me? a way that builds me up, that's edifying to me, and that's edifying to you. And it's that shalom, a balance, not just what's good for you and not just what's good for me, but what's good for both of us and for the whole community. Having said that, I would also assert that the forms of ministry, the administrative categories, the theological categories of ministry that are available to women are a matter of human justice. And that excluding women from certain kinds of ministry because of their biology, because of their social roles, because of some ontological categories, is a matter of human justice that needs to be addressed. And that's part of the reason we celebrate in the ELCA this year the 20th anniversary of the ordination of Lutheran women, because we have moved to greater justice. It's a matter of spiritual importance in that it allows the women who have that calling to live out their calling. And it's a matter of spiritual importance because it allows those women to carry out their calling in a way that's beneficial to the people they minister to. Okay. What it is not is a matter of salvation. And here, my lay activism, my advocacy of lay people rushes to the fore to say, my membership in the body of Christ comes from my baptism. And being ordained or not ordained doesn't change how important I am in the body of Christ. It doesn't change whether or not I'm saved. Being ordained doesn't make me more saved. You are or you aren't. You're justified or you're not, right? And baptism is the place where that happens, not in ordination. Okay. Now, the story of the struggle for access to ordination and the adaptation of that office which follows is available in lots of places. And it's a different story with similarities in each group. So in those of you who saw the slides yesterday, I showed a picture of Anna Howard Shaw, who was ordained in the 1880s. Okay, Lutherans were on 20 years in 1990. So the story is longer or shorter. The particular issues vary, and there's lots and lots of literature about that. And there's lots more that needs to be recorded and preserved and told. As a historian, one of my great fears is the intrusion of the telephone into the historical record, because I know that my friends who are female clergy talk on the phone a lot, and they don't write things down, and it's going to be hard to retrieve those stories. And those are the stories. I mean, you can read lots of places. In this recent publication called An Ordained, Gracia Grindal has an essay called Getting Women Ordained. John Ruman, in his volume Ministries Examined, talks about the process of getting to women to have access to ordination in the Lutheran Church. But it's the adaptation, I think, that we sometimes lose. One of the early studies that was done to consider in 1969 about whether women should be ordained in the Lutheran Church or not had as its fifth point that the question of the ordination of women involves the broader question of ordination itself, the office of the ministry of the whole people of God. And the movement of women into that office has helped our reassessment of that office. Okay, now, what I hope to do today is hear from you some of your stories about how women have ministered to you, how you minister if you are a woman, or how you minister to women if you're not. Those are the happy stories. We're also, of course, open to hearing unhappy stories, and there are a lot of those to be heard. And they're just as important to be heard. To get us started, I'm going to read you something familiar and something unfamiliar. First, some verses from Hebrews 11. I don't want to say very much about it. The only thing I want to say is you will hear one woman's name in these passages. But my point in reading it is not only that there's only one woman's name. My second point is the sense of expectation and hope for the future that we hear in Hebrews 11. So first I'll read that, and then I'm going to read a short story that comes from a homily preached by a friend of mine, which is on the Hebrews 11 passage. So Hebrews 11, it's familiar to you. And I'm going to read it straight out of the RSV, because I think the RSV translation as its exclusive language jars us, will help us to think about these issues. So it's very intentional that I'm leaving that language in. Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. For by it the men of old received divine approval. By faith we understand that the world was created by the word of God, so that what is seen was made out of things which do not appear. By faith Abel offered to God a more acceptable sacrifice than Cain, through which he received approval as righteous, God bearing witness by accepting his gifts. He died, but through his faith he is still speaking. By faith, Enoch was taken up so that he should not see death. He was not found because God had taken him. Now before he was taken, he was attested as having pleased God. And without faith, it is impossible to please him. For whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. By faith, Noah, being warned by God concerning events as yet unseen, took heed and constructed an ark for the saving of his household. By this he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness which comes by faith. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to a place which he was to receive as an inheritance. And he went out not knowing where he was to go. By faith, he sojourned in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked forward to the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. By faith, Sarah herself received power to conceive, even when she was past the age, since she considered him faithful, who had promised. Therefore, from one man, and him as good as dead, were born descendants, as many as the stars of heaven, and as innumerable as the grains of sand by the seashore. These all died in faith, not having received what was promised, but having seen it and greeted it from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For people who speak thus make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of that land from which they had gone out, they would have had an opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. And then we have some more recounting of the history of the Israelite people, some description of the various trials that these people have passed through, and then near the end of the chapter. And all these, though well attested by their faith, did not receive what was promised, since God had foreseen something better for us, that apart from us they should not be made perfect. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with perseverance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Okay. The story is called By Faith, Sarah. And it jumps scenes. There are two scenes intertwined. One is the story of Ed going fishing with a new friend, and the other is the story of Sarah on the same Sunday morning. Sarah is his daughter. Ed sat out on the end of the worn wooden dock, his feet dangling over the edge to steady the small aluminum fishing boat against the tug of the slow current. Here's the food. He passed the old red cooler over to Jeff, who was already in the boat. Set it up there in the bow by the beer. These thermoses go in the compartment on the side. Here's the bait. Jeff dutifully followed every order. Ed had fished from the same boat for 15 years, and everything seemed to have a place where it fit. Everything in its place, Ed slid off the dock into the back of the boat. He worked the choke and keyed the electric starter once, twice. On the third try, as he expected, the little engine gave a mighty cough of purple smoke and roared to life. Ed idled the motor down, and the two graying men gently moved away from the dock and up the river. Ed's love for summer Sunday mornings was one with his love for the river, although it had not always been so. His love for the river went back 30 years, while summer Sundays had always been just like other Sundays, which meant church for the whole family and Sunday school for the kids. Then the kids grew up taking care of Sunday school. And about the same time, the new minister at their church suggested having Sunday evening services during the summer, just for those who went out of town or wanted to use the full day in some other way. Ed was absolutely against the idea, and let it be known. Sunday evening church doesn't carry the weight, he would mutter to anyone who would listen. Then one day, Irene took Ed aside and dropped the idea that with such a service schedule, he could fish early Sunday mornings, like all the folks around town whom he had been disparaging for years and envied. Ed kept silence on the matter for a couple of months and then emerged with the firm conviction that church is church, and just when doesn't make much difference. So summers, Ed fished in the morning and churched in the evening. Late each August, he would stop by the minister's house with 20 pounds of frozen fish from the summer's catch, maybe a couple of pounds of fresh fillets if the day had been good. Ed thought of it as his tithe. And during those seasons when Sunday evening attendance got pretty slim, he hoped those 20 pounds of fish might help tip the scale for the next year. Ed had been sure to let Jeff know that what he was doing this Sunday was not skipping church, just postponing it. Jeff was the new shipping manager from work and potentially a friend, possibly a fishing buddy. Ed hadn't had a real good fishing buddy since Lyle's heart attack. Ed had never demanded that his friends be churchgoers. He just wanted them to know right off that he himself was, and that church was important to him. They had to know that about him and accept it. We'll stay in here along shore for a while where the current is slow. Ed enjoyed introducing an old lake fisherman to the river. This 15-horse engine is good for trawling, and it gets me around, but it doesn't fight the main channel going upstream very well, even like this when the river is low. The setting for this is the author's first parish, which is in northern Iowa, just on the Mississippi River. Earlier, the morning fog had drawn a white curtain down the middle of the river so that the still water trailed off into a vast nothingness. Now the sun had risen enough to cast a silhouette of the trees along the eastern shore. If you look across the river over there, Ed delighted in his role as river guide, what looks like the other shore is really a long, narrow island. It's cut off from the real shore by about a half a mile long slough. When we get enough above it to make up for the current, we'll cross over and slip down the upper end. They moved through the last wisps of morning fog as the sun started to burn the rest of the haze away. It seemed a good time to get to know each other better. Got family? Ed ventured. Yep. Jeff, too, was ready to start exploring this new relationship. There's my wife, Liz. She's got a job here at the school. Both kids are grown boys. That lawyer, Becky, is single. Girl married a pharmacist in Des Moines. No grandkids yet. Wish they'd get on with it. How about you? I met Irene this morning when I stopped by. Got kids? Grandkids? The works. Only two grandkids yet. Ed nosed his boat into the right and began making the way across the river. Then he was off without a pause. Yep, four kids, two boys and two girls. Girl, boy, just like that. Actually, we were supposed to have only three. Irene almost died with Sarah, and the doctor said no more. But you know how that goes. I really don't believe in that birth control stuff anyway. Well, pretty soon another one was on the way. That's when the doctor said he wouldn't release Irene from the hospital until we had something done. Probably should have stopped it, too. Ed's aim across the current of the river was that of an old pro. The world grew silent as they dropped down just above the tip of the island into the shadows. With the river low like this, he exclaimed, and warm, the fish head back here where it's cool as soon as the sun hits. They moved slowly with the current. Ed cut the motor and they drifted to a stop against the trunk of a large old oak, which had fallen in a storm 3 years back and still jutted out from the island back. Bank. Here we are. Toss the anchor out up there just in case we start to drift. The splash of the anchor broke the backwater stillness and sent a blue heron into the air. 250 miles away, Sarah stretched and rolled over on her side. She felt for the alarm switch on her clock radio so its buzzer would not break her stillness. Sarah, too, loved summer Sunday mornings, although she had just discovered them over the past weeks. Summer Sunday mornings had become a time to waken when the sun slipped through her bedroom window. The alarm was an unnecessary precaution. Then, with that gentle, early awakening, there was still time to lie still and to feel the light and life in herself. It was a time to collect her thoughts and let them drift again to family and home and her new home. With that done, there was still time to get up unrushed, to open the shades to full, glorious summer daylight, to feel the still, cool morning air. She glanced into the bathroom mirror to see what work her hair would take and groped past the shower curtain to feel the temperature of the steam. Ed let his hand play in the water as the river streamed slowly by his boat. Warmer than last week. It would get harder to find those deep, cool holes where the fish congregated to seek shelter from the heat. We'll cast downstream over the log. There's a hole down there where it was good last week. Might as well try it again. Now, just a medium sinker with about 2 feet from the hook. No bobber. We'll fish off the bottom. Got to keep a little tension in the line so you can feel any pull. Loop the line over a finger like this, down by the reel. Then you wait. The two settled back. You were starting to tell me about family, Jeff invited. They spoke in hushed tones, the hushed tones of fishermen pretending not to scare the fish.
Right. Well, the oldest is Rachel. Should turn 30 this fall.
Right. Irene and I celebrated our 30th anniversary last summer. The kids threw a party for us. That was nice. So Rachel will be 30 this fall. She's married, has two girls, our two grandkids. They live up in St. Paul. Brian teaches high school. I think he wants to be a superintendent or something, still taking some university classes. Well, Rachel wanted more than anything to go to college, so we did everything we could to put her through. Taught fourth grade for 2 or 3 years. Met Brian in college and got married right after graduation, so I guess it was a good investment. She stopped teaching when the kids came along. The lines hung limply in the water. Don't worry. They'll come swimming up this way as soon as it gets hot out there. Reach that thermos of coffee, okay? There's 2 cups right on top of the cooler. Sarah set her coffee down on the round wooden end table, yellow napkin underneath, by the fresh-cut daisies and bluebells from the side yard. Sarah loved her little house and yard. It was indeed one of the good things that had happened in her life this year. Part of summer Sunday mornings was the chance to delight in such gifts. She sat back with her Sunday paper to see what was happening in the bigger world and to let her hair dry a few more minutes. Damn, look at that. Took the whole bait. See, they're on their way up here now, just a matter of time. Might want to check your bait, too. Sometimes they can nibble it away without you feeling a thing. Ed tore the remaining piece of worm off the hook and flicked it into the water. He found a fat, fresh nightcrawler and expertly slipped it into the hook with a single motion. Then he filled his cup again from the thermos and cast the line back into the stream. Well, next one was Eddie, only one we didn't give a Bible name. Irene thought the first boy should carry my name, so he's Ed Jr. We first started calling him Junior, but Irene decided it would be hard to break ourselves of the habit when he grew up, so it's Eddie. To everyone else, he's Ed, but in the family, he's still Eddie. He's assistant manager of the Sears Garage over in Colton. Always keeps my car in shape, has since high school. Didn't ever go to college, took night classes and got that job with Sears. Now he's assistant manager. Not bad. Was married, maybe too young, didn't last, no kids. I think he's got a friend he's keeping an eye on. Who knows? Watch that line. Something's playing with your bait. Both men held their breath, waiting for the line to move again. The sun filtered through the leaves in a speckled pattern, and its light danced on the water. Sarah walked through moving patterns of light and shadow, of sun and shade, down Oak Street, filling her lungs with air and vibrancy, danced on the gentle puffs of breeze. She always walked to church when the weather permitted, which had been most of the time that summer. It was only 3 blocks, so she walked slowly to make it last. Maybe this afternoon would be a good time to get into the city and see Rachel and Brian, and of course Wendy and Kristen, who were Aunt Sarah's delight. She'd give a call at lunch to make certain they were home. She knew she was always welcome. What a support Rachel had been for her these last years. The two fishermen watched and waited. Dan's the youngest one. Always called him Dan, never Danny. Young Dan, Irene and I sometimes call him to each other. Still in school, university that is. Actually graduated already, but got a scholarship or a fellowship or some such thing to go on some more. Psychology or one of those things. Don't know where he's going to end up. A professor maybe someday. You got one. That's right. Bring him in slow. Hold it. Oh my gosh, there's one on my line. Oh, look at him pull. Easy. No, gone. Just like that. Well, he'll be back. But look at yours. Look at that. Fine bluegill. 3-pounder. Good eating tonight, right? Okay, unhook him. There's a pliers down there on the floor, sort of rusty. The basket's already over the side. The two fishermen, one with a smile, the other with a frown, quietly rebaited their hooks, 2 tiny splashes, and they settled back to wait again. Sarah stood in church as the congregation began the opening hymn. She was new there, but as she got to know more and more people, she was beginning to feel at home. God moves in a mysterious way, they all sang, his wonders to perform. Sarah thought about Mom. Probably would be in church back home right now. Mom often ended up going twice on summer Sundays. She wondered if Dad had gotten a fish yet. Probably. You fearful saints, fresh courage take. Her mind caught up with the rest of the congregation. The clouds you so much dread are big with mercy and shall break in blessing on your head. The stillness of the river grew more intense as the sun now high above and the creatures of the woods seeking shade. Dragonflies skimmed silently over the surface. Only in the distance did the sound of an outboard motor on the main river draw attention to the world beyond Ed and Jeff's concentration on 2 very quiet lines. You missed one, Jeff ventured to break the silence. What? You missed one of your kids. Girl, boy, you said you skipped one. Sarah? Ed played with his line, like there was the feel of a nibble to demand his attention. Well, Jeff insisted. Sarah, yeah, right. Ed searched for his coffee, empty. No way Jeff was going to end up his new fishing buddy if this was all a morning on the river could produce. Right. Sarah's there between Eddie and Dan. I was just getting around to her. Lives up near the cities, near Rachel, went to college. Ed pulled in his line to check the bait. Still there. Again, the soft whir of the reel and the gentle splash of the sinker. Sarah? Jeff was persistent. Right. Went to college, sort of undecided about what she wanted to do, but Rachel had gone, so she had to go too. I thought she should get into something practical, like Rachel did, like teaching, or a husband. but she graduated and still wasn't on to anything. Ed fumbled with the thermos and filled his cup with the last of the coffee. Never had he wanted so much for a fish to strike. And Jeff wouldn't let up. And she finally went back to school again for a few more years. Ed's voice took on a new certainty. Studied library and computers. Library and computers. Works in one of those big libraries at the university. That's what she does. Where all the library stuff is on a computer. Ed had seen one of those visiting Dan in the spring. The river was utterly still. Sarah stood again as they sang another hymn. It was the last stanza. She slowly closed her hymnal about halfway through and gently set it down. Automatically, she smoothed the front of her alb and straightened her stole. And then she stepped into the pulpit to the welcoming eyes of her people. Our text this morning, she began, is from the 11th chapter of the letter to the Hebrews, where we read at the 11th verse, "By faith, Sarah." It's a made-up story.
Lovely made-up story.
Yeah. Dave Carrot, who preached it, you probably know Dave, is a wonderful, wonderful storyteller. And this is one of his. I think it gets at some truths, and I hope it will spark you to want to tell some of your own stories about women and ministry. So, this is my 1/3 discussion, Dan. The third day we do discussion.
Check it out. Right?
Yeah, okay. Anyone?
Well, I find it hard to accept women in different roles than what I stereotype women, and I admit that. I don't know why. If they first start talking about women pastors, okay, but I sure hope none come to our church. I mean, that's crazy, because I have married, raised a family, and worked in the workaday world. And yet I the same way with going to the hospital and having some surgery, and the male nurse came in. I find it hard to accept. And I don't know why that is, but it's just the way I am.
Last week, the four women who have served as pastors at Holden Village were all here. And one of them told, it was an amazing thing, she said, "Well, you know, I was a visitor at the convention where the ALC voted to ordain women, and I thought it was a great thing, but I thought, I'd never want to have a woman for my pastor."
Mm-hmm. And it's the same way with not wanting to have a male nurse. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why that is, but it's just the way it is.
It's not intellectually that you object to it.
No.
Just feels funny?
I suppose it's feeling out of sync. Mm-hmm. Or something. And it's the same way with dealing with the issue of homosexuality in the church. I just don't want to bother with it. I mean, it troubles me, so I stay away, you know. And it's the same way with...
It's always easier to stay the same.
Right.
And
right.
I think that's partly what's going on with Ed
here. Yeah.
Leanne?
Some of those roles were very entrenched in my childhood because I grew up in the South. And it occurred to me when I was a little girl that the only place where I really saw men doing the things that I usually saw women do was in the church. In the church, I saw men holding babies and bathing them. And in the church, I saw men serving the food. Mm-hmm. And in the church, I saw men wearing dresses.
What a perceptive little girl you were.
Well, but it was a bit of a, you know, a jar for me. And the only time I saw women in the front of the church doing the things that I was seeing the men do was to pick up the little communion cups after everybody else was gone so they could go wash them. And I remember those thoughts and those feelings. And I was the first woman I ever heard preach. The first time that a woman gave communion to me, those memories from childhood came back, and there was a new dimension to the sacrament that I had never experienced before, because what was holy and what was every day, was workaday, suddenly came together for me in a way that I had never experienced before. It was same growing. It was when I was in seminary, was the first time I ever received the sacrament from a woman. And it was a very powerful experience. It's not that I've never experienced that again, and that I couldn't possibly experience it again. There was something new there that I touched.
And that I think points to one of the ways that women moving into the clerical role forces us to rethink things. One of the things it forces us to rethink is the role of experience in our participation in the church. Because, doctrinally, nothing is different. And there's a wonderful story that one of the pastors at the university chapel at Valparaiso University tells about a young Missouri Synod first-year student, male student, who came to the communion rail, and a woman, not a pastor, just one of his teachers, it wasn't me, it was someone else, was coming to serve the elements. And this kid didn't know what to do. Because he knew he wasn't supposed to take communion from a woman. This was not right. But he remembered confirmation that said, it's God's action that's important. And so he was able to sort of twist his brain in such a way that he could do it. And he understood what we teach. It's God's action. The sacrament is a foretaste of the feast to come, no matter who gives it to you. But what he was experiencing and what Leanne describes experiencing is not unimportant. And I sometimes talk about this, about making a toast. And you make a toast with champagne, right? It's a symbolic action, right? But if you do it with styrofoam coffee cups, it just doesn't seem the same as if you have beautiful crystal flutes. It's still a toast. It's still champagne. It's still a celebration. But the experience is really different. And one of the things that we're learning to do is to talk about the experience. And sometimes the experience is unfamiliar and maybe even frightening, because it makes us think in new ways. There are other experiences people would like to talk about.
Three non-clergy, my mom in the retirement home.
Talk a little louder, because there's mechanical interference.
Right. Thank you. My mom in a retirement home, fighting with a Jewish woman over something at lunch, I don't remember why, how, and then confessing to us later in a family gathering how she walked down the hall to make amends and confess what had been wrong in her, and how she ministered to me because in my house it was more difficult to grow up loving Jews than blacks. She was a terribly selfish woman, my mother, way in advance of being affirmed of who she was. But boy, she taught a lot. Ginny, my dear wife, National Conference of Christians and Jews, with a ministry to the head of the sociology department at the University of Chicago, who didn't understand how to communicate across the cultural lines. Amazing woman. And my daughter, Mary, walking into prison cells in Washington, D.C., that her father, I have it on good word, would have been scared to go into, and ministering to young men who had been arrested. I'm grateful.
Yeah, Peter.
I wrote a story about the daughter reminded me of a friend from college who continues to teach the world by reproduction and is about to deliver a sixth child, who continues to go to the prisons in downstate Illinois and work in an arts program in her eighth and ninth month of pregnancy and take the nursing baby into the prison with her to work with the prisoners and to collect their art and sell it in the community. That's a good story. The a sad service, my first woman pastor was denied a call, at least in part, on the basis of her good looks. When she admitted that she was nervous about going out in emergency calls in Chicago at night by herself, and said that she would call on some of the members of the church council to make those calls with her, some of the women were very nervous about this single, attractive woman calling their husbands at night to go out with them, get involved with her on pastoral calls. And that was part of the reason that she had to wait for 2 years for her second call.
Yeah.
I think also when you was talking about talents and how to use them, I feel so often we have talents and we're afraid to use them because we've been set back with what we traditionally do as women. But, you know, if we go on to seek our calling, make sure our calling and vocation, sure, you know, then I feel that as we go throughout doing our daily talents, all these things are going to come out in us. You know, because I never thought that I would be standing in front of many people speaking. And the first time I did it, and it was men, you know, sitting in the audience, I thought, you know, oh no, I can't do this. And especially my pastor, I was scared. And the whole time I was speaking, I was constantly getting that confirmation to say, for him to shake his head to say, you're doing okay. It's okay. Yes, you can go on. It's okay. But as I continued through, you know, teaching, Bible study, and ministry within my church and elsewhere, I feel very comfortable about it now. Because I feel, you know, it's part of my calling. And as I go, knowing that it's talent also, you know, and as we begin to use that more and more, I think we will know exactly what we can do as women.
calling, a good sense of our calling and our vocation that springs from our identity as children of God, can help in the hard places to say, you don't think I should do it? Remember the apostles saying the same, you don't think we should do this? God thinks we should do it.
Yes.
Yeah. In the back.
I work in a veterans hospital where 95% of the patients are male, and about 50% of the physicians are women.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had many of the patients tell me, and I know you can't make generalities, but I've had many say, I prefer the women doctors because they take the time to listen. They don't act like they're in such a hurry. They really take the time to listen to me. And I think that's just an example of using a gift in that situation.
Can others of you, Elmer shared some specific people, so did some others. Can others of you think of a woman who has spoken the gospel to you or ministered to you the gospel, made you feel whole, made you feel real?
I have one. I took a class in women mystics, and this Thea Bowman, who is a black woman, I did a little speech and paper. She was a woman who was, if I can remember my data here, her grandmother, she was a slave, her grandmother was a slave. And this woman was very influential in the black community in the Roman Catholic Church, and she transcended her gifts through music and helping the black community, and she was very powerful, and she was very well educated too. She went on to get, I think, her PhD. I was real impressed. She just died last year at the age of 52, but was very influential in with the black community in the Roman Catholic Church. And also, speaking for myself as a woman, I was very, I would think about things like you were saying, I don't want to deal with these things. But as women, if we never deal with them and if we never tell our story and take risks, nothing will ever change. I find for myself, working in the profession of nursing, for a while I thought I would leave because I feel a lot of oppression as a woman and as a nurse by the hierarchy of the male-dominated physician, and also the institution of the hospital. And I see a lot, I have kind of gone beyond that, although sometimes, if I listen to the inner voice within me, it's hard to take a stand and to confront what I believe in. And I have started doing that, and I'm thinking, I'm going to get in trouble. I'm going to be called down to by my supervisor, but nothing's happened. And people are coming up now and talking to me, and I think, in my own way, I'm role modeling. And I still sometimes get fearful, and I think, but the more I do it, the easier it's becoming. And I'm even having people, calling me up, and I really feel really a lot of power. And so I've decided I'm going to stay where I am and just do what I'm doing. And I don't know what, the future will be, but it's kind of interesting.
We'll pray the holy prayer for you.
Well, just the other day, Nancy, is it Winder or Winder?
Winder.
Winder, preaching here, preached gospel to me and preached hope. And it was a powerful experience for me, not only because of what she said, but also because my teenage daughters were listening. And I thought, what an incredible role model. That there's so much hope there. because they now have a role model. And when I grew up, it was the farthest thing from my mind that a woman could preach. So I think that example, you know, both as a theoretical one and just for what she said that night, was powerful.
And I think also this issue about seeing women in leadership roles, even not everyone becomes a leader, but seeing that it's possible allows those who don't take leadership roles to do what they do, knowing that it was possible. It's kind of freeing, even if you're not going to be president, to know that you could be, removes a barrier from what you do. Yeah. Dan.
I've just been in a church. We're kind of on the other end. We're the ones who seem to introduce the trouble in the church. But our one of our pastors is an open lesbian woman, our co-pastors. And it's been really interesting to watch the mutual ministry going on. She went through a very bitter experience a year and a half ago where her church, when she came out because her partner wanted to be part of the church as well, Kathy Ann was expelled from the church. And so she had a real crisis about whether or not she could continue being an ordained minister in the Christian church with the kind of experience she had. And my church is predominantly gay and lesbian membership. And it's been a wonderful thing she's provided a beautiful ministry for our church. And so there are many of us, both men and women in the church, who value her ministry, but our church has also been able to minister to her and bring back some reconciliation and affirming her call to ministry and giving her a community where that can be played out and her gifts can really blossom.
Let me just close by reading again this last part. This is Hebrews 12. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with perseverance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Thank you. Amen. Yeah.